From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, the CEO of Beaumont Medical System talks about hospital capacity and what lies ahead.
The UK variant that is dominating Michigan, we do testing on it, and it's well over 70, 80%. It's so dominant, there's really no reason to try and measure it anymore.
Also, University of Michigan President Mark Schlissel on plans for the fall.
We are discussing and considering whether to mandate vaccination. Oh, 30 or 40 universities around the country have already done so.
And how one AM radio station geared up to get the facts out about COVID.
They began to have interviews on La Explosiva to break down step by step what was happening, whether it was with the pandemic and then later with the vaccines.
Those stories and more coming up on today's episode of Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later today, we'll talk with two reporters at MLive following a long overdue reckoning with sexual harassment in Lansing's political world. That's coming up in the second half of the show. But first, the University of Michigan is wrestling as much as any of the state's institutions with COVID-19. Joining us to talk about the remaining academic year and what may lie ahead is University President Dr. Mark Schlissel. We should mention the university holds Michigan Radio's broadcast license. President Schlissel, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks, April. It's a pleasure to be here and join you.
How are things going as the pandemic school year wraps up?
Well, I'm actually quite proud of how our community, our students and faculty and staff have adapted to these challenging circumstances. Looking back across the year, we've had no COVID transmission in our classrooms. Our research labs are up and running again and not a source of transmission. You know, we're operating them at somewhat lower density with face coverings, but we're almost up to full strength in research. And we're following social distancing guidelines in all of our indoor spaces. Yeah, but it's been a challenging year, especially for our students, but they're tough and they're resilient.
That said, the current phase that we're in right now is uniquely challenging. We saw the B.1.1.7 variant begin from a clinical standpoint at U of M and the surrounding community here in Ann Arbor. The variant swelled beyond Washtenaw County, and you know we're still unraveling the story of how it spread so quickly and so voraciously. But is there anything you would have done differently if you could go back through the year?
Oh, gosh, you know, I think you have to approach all of this with a great sense of humility. You know, we've had to learn as we go. We've had to rely, of course, on our experts, but also bring our community along. We've had to approach this with really great humility. And, you know, those are some of the bigger lessons. I wish we had ramped up our testing program earlier. Early on, we were using Michigan Medicine, you know, our own major healthcare system. But they really weren't set up to ramp up and do massive surveillance testing on a college campus. So we had to get that going, provide ways for students to be able to adapt. We've learned a lot of lessons.
You know, the state's public health infrastructure is pivoting to a message of personal responsibility and people making individual decisions in a way that will take their own health and the health of their community into account. Would you have any advice for Governor Whitmer, or do you think differently about how this case is made now than you might have, say, 2 years ago?
Oh, you know, one thing I've learned is not to second guess well-intentioned, hardworking, serious, you know, data-driven leaders like the governor, because until you sit in their chair, you really don't know all the various inputs that a leader has to balance. I'd say even when our state was under very stringent regulation, with a state of 10 million people, it always comes down to personal responsibility. You can't use the police to enforce your way to uniform public safety all across the state. It relies on most people buying into the message and the leadership and the science that suggests how to fight the pandemic. And until, you know, quite recently, Michigan was the model for our nation in terms of keeping cases low and striking that balance between economic vitality and public safety. I think in this latter stage of the pandemic, I think our state is suffering from pandemic fatigue. This lifestyle has really gotten to people. The weather's getting better. People have this sense of hope that comes from the vaccine, and maybe they're changing their behaviors too soon. And as you mentioned earlier, this variant, the B117 variant, we had, you know, one of the first reported cases in the state here at U of M, but there's evidence of multiple points of entry into the state. And the example of the United Kingdom shows that the thing spreads really, really quickly. It's much more transmissible. So I think there are a lot of factors that contribute to the challenges our state has faced now. But for the first time, really, during the epidemic, I'm optimistic about the months ahead. The warmer weather will be doing more outside, and it's definitely safer outside. The vaccine is penetrating pretty widely across the state. I know here on campus, faculty and staff and students have very anxiously waited their turn, and now they're getting vaccinated in significant numbers. The vaccine, the RNA-based vaccines, the Pfizer vaccine and the Moderna vaccine have proven incredibly safe, amazingly effective. So there's really a cause for optimism now coming out of this challenging couple of months of wintertime.
How do you think things might look differently in the fall for students and faculty?
Yeah, you know, the way I'd have to characterize the ambiance on campus across this past academic year that's just wrapping up now, we're doing graduation in about 10 days or so, is a lack of joy. You know, people really had their heads down. They weren't allowed to safely socialize. It was a very different ambiance. The campus was much less dense than usual because most of our classes were remote. The fall should be quite different. You know, we're expecting to deliver the vast majority of our classes in person, the major exceptions being large classes where we can't really get enough distancing to safely put 100 people in a room together. So at least at the beginning of the semester, our large classes will be remote. We're hoping to drive very high levels of vaccination, and that will allow us to have a much more normal semester. We're hopeful that the big house will have fans, probably in limited numbers to start, but then growing through the football season. Our student clubs and activities will be active. Our rec sports facilities will be running. And as I said, with most of our classes in person and the you know, dorms operating near capacity, a much more normal semester based on this miraculous vaccination.
It's interesting to hear you mention a lack of joy. In your view, is joy a necessary part of the higher ed experience?
You know, in many ways, I think it is. We deliver content in the classrooms, and we do it at a high level. We were able to pivot to online instruction, on average, very, very effectively. A lot of the Michigan experience, though, comes from the interaction between our students and informal interactions with our faculty. And those were the things that were diminished. A lot of our learning happens when you put students together from all around the state and all around the country and all around the world in a living and learning environment where they learn in the classroom, but they learn just as much outside the classroom. And that outside the classroom piece was really inhibited because of the public health interventions that we had to put in place to try to keep people safe and healthy.
The university, I know, has been requiring weekly COVID tests to enter certain buildings. Will the university require vaccination to attend classes in person this fall?
Well, you know, this winter, all of our students who are coming to campus have to have weekly testing. And, you know, the good news is the test positivity rate, even as we've had cases, has remained low, below 1%, which is really quite good from a public health perspective. Interestingly, more of our staff community, the rate of COVID's a bit higher amongst our staff than it is amongst our students right now. So we're discussing right now issues around vaccination. We're trying our very best to drive as close to 100% vaccination as possible. And the closer we get, the more normal the semester will feel. And more importantly, the healthier people will stay and the less likely that we'll run into serious illness with these vaccines. I'm optimistic that a very high fraction of students will be vaccinated before the fall semester. We are discussing and considering whether to mandate vaccination. Oh, 30 or 40 universities around the country have already done so. It's complicated. We want to be sure that we make, you know, good, consistent decisions that strike all the right balances. So we'll probably have more to say about that in the days and weeks ahead.
You have said that your worst case scenario is that a variant of the virus escapes coverage of the vaccine and that we might be in a continued cycle of distancing and masks. But if so, knowing what you know now about how higher education has been able to pivot, How long can the system sustain what it's doing right now?
Gosh, that's a very difficult question, April. I don't think this worst case scenario will be the case, but it certainly is possible. But at the end of the day, you know, we're obligated to maintain the health and safety of our faculty, students, and staff as we pursue our mission. And we'll certainly be in better shape than we were a year ago in terms of our capacity to test and the lessons we've learned in managing a big campus through a pandemic. I hope we don't have to do it, but you know, we have many levers and tools that we can use. And we also follow guidance that comes nationally and also from our state. So sort of with my immunologist hat on, because for years I ran an immunology research lab, so serendipitously it turns out that I have some personal expertise in the area. It's possible, but it's not likely that there'll be a variant to arise in the coming months that makes the vaccines dramatically less effective, because we're starting from a point of very high effectiveness. The other thing is the way these vaccines were made, using a messenger RNA to activate an immune response, it's really fast and easy to make variant vaccines. So right now, I bet you that Pfizer and Moderna and perhaps other companies are working on vaccines tailored to the known variants. So down the road, switching vaccines or making a vaccine that covers not just the main strain, but emerging variants, it's just not as technically difficult as it was to make the very first vaccine. So we've got a lot of arrows in the quiver. Is that the expression? Or mm-hmm. we have many options.
I didn't hear an answer conclusively about another year or 2 years or 5 years. So I'm just going to conclude that's something that you're hoping to avoid.
Well, of course, April, but we're going to do whatever it takes. Of course, you know, the University of Michigan's been here for 200 years. If nothing else, the pandemic has proven the importance of education and research. It's research that has allowed us to overcome a global pandemic or make significant progress in less than a year. Imagine if this were 50 or 60 years ago. You know, we would not have known what the virus was. We wouldn't have sequenced its genome. We wouldn't have a diagnostic test. And we certainly wouldn't have a vaccine in less than a year. So the mission of the university is critical, both education and research, whether the pandemic is over in a few months or whether it continues on for a couple more years.
Mark Schlissel is the president of the University of Michigan. President Schlissel, thanks for your time.
Thanks very much, April. Stay healthy. Thanks for your attention. Bye-bye.
Next up, we speak with the head of Beaumont Health System about how the limits of capacity are being stretched by the third surge of COVID-19. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. This week, Michigan set a dubious record, the highest number of hospitalizations due to COVID, 4,158 people for the first time since the pandemic began. That's according to state records of confirmed cases. Smaller hospitals are definitely feeling the weight, and even some of Michigan's most robust medical systems say the current rate of infection is not sustainable. John Fox is the CEO of Beaumont Health System, and he's with us now. Mr. Fox, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, April. Appreciate the time.
We heard last week from Beaumont that things were dire at several locations. Can you bring us up to date about where things stand this week?
Certainly. We are struggling here in Michigan with an incredibly difficult situation. At Beaumont, 6 weeks ago, we had about 130 COVID inpatients across our eight hospitals. Since then, the number has shot up to about 800. So it's kind of like a flood that has come in with respect to patients suffering. COVID right now, the UK variant that is dominating Michigan, we do testing on it, and it's well over 70, 80%. It's so dominant, there's really no reason to try to measure it anymore, is much more infectious. So in the first surge of a year ago, back in March, April of 2020, and the subsequent one in October, November, December of 2020, we were dealing with the old COVID virus that was not as infectious. This one is more dangerous in that the infection rate is so high that people who are infected really can transfer it to a lot more people a lot faster. And that is what is driving the situation here in Michigan. Our positivity rate when we test patients for COVID normally was about 5%. Now it's close to, or it has actually exceeded 20%. When it gets that high, you know it's running fairly rampant out there in the community. And it's stressing all of healthcare in Michigan, but that's the Beaumont story.
At this stage of the game, what percentage of your medical staff has been able to be vaccinated?
Well, the total medical community is north of 65%. That's all of our employees. We have 38,000 employees. There's variation within that. Some areas, it's a relatively low percentage in the 30s. Some is very high percentage, more in the frontline care workers, definitely up in the 90% zone.
Institutions of all kinds and of all sizes are dealing with questions that some of their staff may have about vaccination and some hesitancy. Is there anything specific that you've learned about the reasons why people may not have scheduled their doses, or what the hospital or what the health system can do to try to encourage them to do so?
Well, we are trying to encourage them, and we communicate internally and externally. The vaccine works. We have had, actually anybody who's vaccinated, we have had no deaths since the vaccines have become available for those who have been vaccinated. You still can contract the virus, but you're going to have a much more mild case. And frankly, patients who are vaccinated do very well. Most of them never even need to be hospitalized. So it's very effective at immunizing you from the virus, including the new B.1.1.7 variant. I think there are a lot of different reasons people are waiting. Suspicious of any new drug or agent, and that's not an irrational thing in most cases. There's a lot of what I call wait and see going on. But that's a dangerous proposition because, again, it's not like waiting and seeing in the first two surges. This third surge is different. And that really can, confound people's historical thinking about, I've not been vaccinated all through this. So, I'm really taking the same risk I was taking in 2020. That is not the case with this virus.
I wanted to ask about the capacity issues that you're dealing with. They have pretty obvious consequences in places like COVID treatment units and ICUs. Are there other repercussions throughout Beaumont, say, for example, in emergency rooms?
There certainly are. We have a new wave of patients that we did not have before, certainly before COVID-19 presented itself, that frankly can disrupt a lot of the other healthcare services we're trying to provide. We are open for all of our healthcare services. I think our frontline care workers, true healthcare heroes, are doing an outstanding job. But it is disruptive when you have a growing census. That has an impact. It just floods the system. And again, it's a lot of our colleagues around the state and other healthcare systems are experiencing much of the same thing. For whatever reason, we are just into it bigger, and we have a higher volume than others, probably just by a function of our size.
Is there any way to know how many people might, or do you worry at all about how many people might be turned away for lack of capacity, either in the ER or in any other units?
We worry about it. We have not had to do that. Our staff has responded. They've improvised. Our nurses, physicians, respiratory therapists have just all been extraordinary. And so they make it work. We're fortunate. We have eight hospitals in our system. That archipelago of capacity is something we rely on every day. Every day we have a call on our emergency operations center that I participate in, plus 160 other leaders from across the system. And we go hospital by hospital. What's the situation? How are we doing in the critical care units? How many are waiting in the ER? Does somebody need ventilators? Do we need to move equipment around? So this is a daily routine that we've been into for all three surges. And frankly, it's really enabled us to be fairly responsive. We're extremely proud of what we've been able to do to treat our communities for the COVID-19 infections that they suffer.
Are some locations still doing outdoor triage?
We have some areas set up that are doing that to relieve congestion in the ER, and those are going well. They seem to be working fairly well. Again, the goal is to get treatment to patients faster. And if we can divide it up and provide outpatient triage areas and tents, a lot of them are heated tents and things like that, and do it comfortably, and the patients appreciate, you know, having a much shorter wait time and getting their clinical issue evaluated and taken care of by our, again, frontline staff.
You know, some people have looked at that shift in the demographic of who's being hospitalized right now. Some have looked at the current death rates compared with the initial surge and said, well, you know what, it's not so bad this time around. Would you agree with that assessment?
That's a risky assessment. I think that the mortality rate is substantially less here and across America than it was in the first surge, but it is not zero. And I think that's what people need to remember, that unfortunately, we have patients dying of COVID-19 every day here in Michigan, and they are on average younger patients than occurred in the first two surges. And that's obviously it's a tragedy for the patient and their families. It's also very hard on the staff, who just hate to lose any patient to COVID-19 or any other illness.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking today with John Fox. He's the CEO of Beaumont Health System, which has been speaking out about capacity issues within recent days. John, are there places that Beaumont can transfer people when various hospitals are at capacity?
We transfer people internally and have not had to do that that much. We basically are flexing within each of our eight hospitals and are adjusting sometimes the surgery schedule or other things that can be, you know, deferred safely and not immediately done that day. We do talk to our colleagues around the state and in the area about the potential to need to transfer. We have just not had to do that yet. I will say that since this is our third surge, each one we get better and better at managing it, something we'd rather not have to do. But I think we have learned a lot in the past year in terms of how to respond to a pandemic like COVID-19, even if it is mutating on us into a more problematic form.
You know, in the weeks of the initial surge last year, Southeast Michigan had some large field hospitals that were prepared at great expense and very quickly and ready to go. And they never served that many patients. It turned out that COVID patients have a lot of needs at the front end of care, like a strong diagnosis on where the early progression is headed and some quick analysis of what kind of triage treatment is best. And then in later stages, the patients who were hospitalized for longer times for COVID tended to be older or have comorbidities or physical therapy needs, all the things that brick-and-mortar hospitals do really well. How are you thinking about the options within our healthcare system if the current infection trend continues and we are dealing with more and more patients? I mean, are there options to expedite transfers or expand ICU capacity if Beaumont gets to a point where you have to look outside the system?
I think that there are options that we can consider. Again, the first job of government is to protect the health and well-being of the populations they serve. So I think, and we do have a lot of discussions going on with government officials about what may be needed around that. I do think that we have to be very careful about opening up large new facilities, field hospitals, because frankly, the beds are the easiest thing to get. The hardest thing to get is staff. It's getting the nurses, physicians, the respiratory therapists, phlebotomists, everybody else needed to take care of those patients. And as you just alluded to, one key issue is having the clinical depth to do it. Many of these patients that are COVID positive and are inpatients have other medical comorbidities that need to be managed. You need a certain amount of depth to do that. You need, you know, ICU availability and medical subspecialties available to manage these patients. And a pop-up field hospital sometimes can, you know, often does not have that kind of depth. We have some beds we could open up, but we cannot do it without making sure we have adequate staff. And, you know, we will not do that from a safety standpoint.
I wanted to ask you about one of the treatments that Governor Whitmer has indicated she's interested in seeing hospitals ramp up, and that's monoclonal antibody treatments. This is a procedure by which people are infused with antibodies that can help in the early stages of infection, that can help avoid a hospitalization. Do you have any idea how many patients per day Beaumont hospitals are able to do that with at the moment?
I do not have that handy. I will tell you that we use those tools every day. It is the monoclonal antibodies. It's also remdesivir, which has been effective in mitigating the effect of the disease on many patients and controlling the condition and reducing the severity. So part of the improvement we have at Beaumont Health, but I think also nationally, is these medications are now much more readily available. You have to use them in a certain way. Remdesivir, for example, requires a 5-day regimen of infusion therapy. So we may treat a patient for 3 days in the hospital. They may be healthy enough that they could do the last 2 days outpatient. But if we don't have an outpatient infusion center available with capacity to handle those patients, then they may wind up staying in a hospital an extra day or two. But on your point, there are more therapies out there, certainly than were available at the start of the pandemic. They are effective, but again, this is not a risk-free proposition. The best thing people can do is to get vaccinated and to continue to follow all the public health guidance we've been given on masking, social distancing, and hand hygiene. You want to stay safe, you do that. Otherwise, you're playing a little bit of medical Russian roulette.
Where does Beaumont stand right now with respect to elective surgeries?
We are still doing elective surgeries. We analyze that, frankly, every day on a hospital-by-hospital basis. And some surgeries we are deferring if they're going to consume inpatient capacity that we have to free up for our COVID population. So it's important that the healthcare system remain open for all the other non-COVID conditions out there. And that was one of the difficulties of the first surge, is a lot of care that was needed for non-COVID issues was deferred in oncology, cardiovascular, and other areas. And that is a problem, I believe, for patients. I think the research that'll be done post-COVID around this is really going to demonstrate that there was a cost to that that was not insignificant and something that we're going to need to figure out should we ever be in this situation again.
You know, you mentioned earlier that one of the biggest problems right now is not equipment, it's not beds, it's people. And we hear that the burnout that hospitals in the region are facing is significant. Do you have any idea how many staff you've lost this year?
We track that. I don't have that handy. Here's what's going on. We have, the way I put it to people, we really have two tragedies. The first one is the pandemic and the effect of that disease on the mortality and morbidity, the overall health of our communities. But the second tragedy, if you will, real stress, is we are now in our 13th month of this pandemic. It has become a marathon. And again, our healthcare heroes, our frontline care workers are doing an extraordinary job that America cannot under-recognize or cannot recognize enough in terms of thanking them for all that they do. And we are doing everything that we can to ease their situation. We have food trucks going to our hospital, providing all of our staff with free food and things like that. Anything that would give them a boost for the day, we want to do. We also remind them to pace themselves and not get too overworked. We juggle staff to do that and make sure we control the burnout risk as much as we can. But we cannot underestimate the sacrifice that they have provided, if you will, to our community. And it's not a cost-free sacrifice.
Beaumont Health System CEO John Fox has been my guest today. John, thank you very much, both for the work that everyone at Beaumont's doing and for your time.
Well, thank you. And if anybody can thank a healthcare worker today, they're all healthcare heroes, whether they're at Beaumont or anywhere else. It really helps them recharge their batteries to be recognized. So appreciate your ongoing coverage of this critical issue.
Coming up, a Spanish language radio station that has been a huge resource for Michigan's Latino community during the pandemic.
There was very few people or few entities, governmental or otherwise, that were informing this specific community. In terms of established media, there hasn't been any established media or legacy media outlets that I've seen that have addressed this.
That conversation's next. This is Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The need to reach people in Michigan from all walks of life with facts about COVID and vaccination has perhaps never been greater. We know that communities of color have been the hardest hit by the pandemic, whether people are working in agricultural settings, in white-collar jobs, the service industry, or hospitality. One Detroit journalist just published a story about a small but mighty media effort to get the facts for Spanish speakers about the surge. And the key player in this story is an AM radio station delivering to folks in Southeast Michigan, 1480 La Explosiva.
New music now.
WSBS, 1480 AM, Salem, Detroit, in Michigan.
The hits are on.
La más activa es La Explosiva.
Martina Guzman is a senior fellow for race and justice journalism for the Damon J. Keith Center for Civil Rights at Wayne State University Law School. You've seen her byline coming from several Detroit outlets. This latest story comes through Bridge Detroit. Martina, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
So for folks who may not be big AM radio listeners, can you tell us a little bit about 1480 La Explosiva?
It's a small independent radio station that kind of sprung up about 20 years ago, and it was there to serve a need that the Spanish-speaking community didn't have its own radio station where they can listen to Mexican music, music from back home, you know, DJs that informed them of things that were happening in the community and informing them in their own language.
How did you find out that the station was ramping up its informational work in recent months?
Well, when the pandemic hit in March, roughly March of last year, I knew and understood that in the Latino community, people were sort of desperate for information. I knew that personally because I live in the community, but also it was all over Facebook. I was starting to see misinformation and disinformation being posted. People didn't understand the virus. And I felt that there was very few people or few entities, governmental or otherwise, that were informing this specific community. And so I think weeks into the pandemic, people felt the same and they started to step up and they started to get things translated into their language. And specifically, La Explosiva had this broad reach. I mean, they could reach hundreds of people at one time. And the DJ, Alex Resendez, also known as El Batman, became committed, like incredibly committed to informing the public and how important this was and to getting facts out. And so he committed himself and the rest of the DJs to get this information out as quickly as it was coming out and as quickly as press releases were being distributed by Governor Whitmer and her office. And whenever there was a press conference, they made themselves available to do, you know, hands-on interpreting for the Spanish-speaking community.
Yeah. As folks might have heard on our show in recent weeks, even if a person lives in Ypsilanti or southwest Detroit that might have a decent-sized critical mass, it's not always easy to know what the local health department has to offer. The public health infrastructure just isn't there yet in terms of outreach to Latino communities. How did the station see its role? Were Alex and the other hosts trying to direct folks to organizations in the community that might be able to help, or just to do a more broader outreach and pave the way, give people good information about what was going on and maybe get them thinking seriously about vaccination?
Yeah, well, Alex Resendez used to work for the Mexican consulate here in Detroit before he stayed on and began to work at La Explosiva. So he understood that the information that needed to get out was incredibly valuable, and the timeliness of it was important. But he also understood his audience. He knows that the Mexican community will more than likely connect to someone that they already know. So he partnered with Chas Clinic. And Chas Clinic in Southwest Detroit is an incredibly well-respected, I mean, it's considered a national model in terms of community clinics. It's currently celebrating its 50th anniversary, and a majority of the Latino immigrant community goes there for either, you know, to see a gynecologist or to have their babies delivered and everything else. So what Alex did was he partnered with the doctor there, Dr. Valbuena, and they began to have interviews on La Explosiva to break down step by step what was happening, whether it was with the pandemic and then later with the vaccines. And they were able to do it in a way that was digestible for the community and in a way that people understood. And he's an authoritative and very respected figure, Dr. Valbuena. So when he spoke, people listened. And Alex knew that. So they had dozens of these kinds of meetings throughout the pandemic. And as information was changing, you know, they were there to update the community.
Do you think that La Explosiva's effort has in any way had an opposite effect? I mean, obviously, they're getting information out to the community. But do you think public health providers might become aware of this and might be redoubling their efforts in any way to try to meet the need that's out there in the community?
That's hard to say. I do know that La Explosiva has had an impact, right? I mean, if you're listening to the radio station, they pause at multiple times a day to sort of update information. And then they do these one-on-ones with Dr. Valbuena and other experts about the information that's coming out. But whether the public health officials have sort of begun to understand that, you know, the importance of La Explosiva is hard to say. And I do know that the radio station, for them, it doesn't matter. They're committed. They have to do this, and they understand the importance of it.
Have you seen any other media going the distance in this way, trying to be the megaphone for the information that people need right now?
Well, sure. La Explosiva is not alone in giving out information to the community. In fact, community leaders like Raquel Castañeda Lopez, who sits on the city council and represents this district, Gabriela Santiago Romero, who's sort of a young leader in the community, Vivi Mesa, who works for the county, the Wayne County, all stepped up and began to help and get information out and translate information, and they were doing it via social media. There is a small media outlet called Tostada Magazine that's also online, that also at the beginning of the pandemic was translating information and getting it out to the community as quickly as it was coming in. I mean, this was really important, heavy breaking news, and people needed to be informed. And I think you remember, April, in the beginning, like, it just changed weekly. You know, there was a different direction, it seemed, from the administration and or from the CDC as it was rolling out. You know, the people who were translating and giving out information had to change with it. Now, in terms of established media, no. I mean, hasn't been any established media or legacy media outlets that I've seen that have addressed this. You know, and this isn't just the Latino community. I mean, this is the Arab Middle Eastern community. This is the Bengali community. You know, there are different communities that have these needs to get information out. And I think that within those communities, people have stepped up. But I don't know if I've seen any legacy media outlets do that, inform the people in that way. I think a lot of people in the community are hesitant. about taking the vaccine. And that's due to a couple of things. They don't have a connection to sort of say Dr. Fauci and listening to Dr. Fauci when he comes out on NPR, you know, and saying, take this, it's important. You know, they're not sitting around watching as, you know, Joe Biden gets an injection for everyone to see that it's safe and doing it and setting an example. A lot of the Mexican community, they work in the service sector. They're considered essential workers. They're working in grocery stores. They were the people who once worked in restaurants. They're the people that are working in supermarkets. They don't have always the time to be informed in the way other people do who are working from home. So they are hesitant about it. They are hesitant about taking it. And with the Latino community and the Black community, there's a long history and reasons why. And I think that the more they are informed, the more information they get, hopefully that'll change. But overcoming disinformation is a challenge. It's a challenge to all media outlets and all individuals who are trying to get facts-based information out. And so I think that the Latino community falls somewhere in the middle. I would say a large majority are getting the vaccine, but for those who don't, you know, they're either connecting with people online who aren't giving facts, or they're listening to members of their community who don't necessarily know what's going on. And as a community, collectively, we need to tackle that.
Martina Guzman's story appears today in Bridge Detroit about how one Mexican radio station became a COVID lifeline. Martina is a senior fellow for race and justice journalism for the Damon Keith Center for Civil Rights at Wayne State's Law School. Martina, it's a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, April.
When the Me Too movement gained momentum a couple of years ago, it stood out to some folks working at our state's capital that Lansing never really had to reckon with the culture of sexual harassment ingrained in politics and lobbying. The discussion now, though, is perhaps more open than it's ever been. Recent reports of sexual harassment in Lansing's political spheres have been reported over the past several weeks. And now MLive reporters Emily Lawler and Lauren Gibbons have followed up with a survey of 40 women working in Lansing, 32 of whom say they have experienced harassment, from pinches to propositions to gender-based discrimination. Emily and Lauren join us now. Welcome both of you back to Stateside.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks.
Can you tell us a little bit about the survey that you designed for this and what you found?
Sure. Yeah. So when we were coming at this story, we really wanted to talk about this being broader than one person, one bad actor. But we acknowledge and recognize the fact that a lot of women who are experiencing the brunt of this kind of behavior are not necessarily going to feel comfortable coming forward. So we designed the survey as a means to give them a voice, give them a little bit of a way to contribute to our reporting in a meaningful way without having to, you know, potentially put their careers at risk or make it more difficult for them to come forward. So we spoke to a lot of people on the record, but we spoke to scores more off the record or on background, many of whom were some of our participants in this survey.
The kind of things that women talk to you about were not simply lingering looks or a hand on the shoulder, although I get a strong sense those are part of the issue, too. The title of this story is Butt Pinching, Threesome Requests, and a Glass Ceiling. How far in the past were the incidents that women told you about?
It really varied. I think that some of the women who talked to us, like Lauren mentioned, it was things they experienced when they were younger. And I do just want to clarify that I think that the pattern I've seen is that it's not that they have gotten less of that as they've gotten older. It's just that, you know, that they're in better protected positions and I think less vulnerable than the younger women who are getting this all the time and then they got earlier in their careers. But, you know, when it comes down to it, there's sort of a persistent issue with this around the Capitol. Certainly some of the instances in that story were older than others, some were newer than others. And, you know, it's funny, some of the people I talked to, including on background, would say things like, well, you know, this is the one that's fresh on my mind because it happened recently, but I don't even know if it's the worst thing that's happened. Like, you know, I think that there was sort of this general understanding that this is so pervasive that it's frankly, it's easy to forget about half of the things that happen to you. And you never know why the ones that stick with you do that. I mean, in some cases you do, certainly. And I think everyone has sort of their highlights reel of worsts, but you know, more minor things are happening to the extent that women can't even remember sometimes all of the incidents that they've been a part of.
The conversation is changing in Lansing because, you know, we have articles like this and women who can come forward to talk about it. But do you think the culture is changing, either of you? Lauren, would you like to start?
You know, in addition to the folks that we spoke with in and around Lansing, we also talked to several experts in this subject to get kind of the national perspective. And one thing that the research has really shown is that younger women are a lot less likely to sweep it under the rug. We're seeing kind of this groundswell of younger women being more willing to go on the record or to talk about these instances of inappropriate behavior more frankly. And so I do think in that sense, since the Me Too movement started, we have seen a greater willingness, especially on the part of younger women, to make this an issue. But it's not just women at this point who need to be having this conversation. For true cultural change to happen, this not only needs to be acknowledged, it needs to be taken extremely seriously by men. So I think it does remain to be seen. And, you know, I hope with sharing these stories and continuing to report on this issue, we are able to see not just the solutions working better, but also just a more comfortable place for women to work. Because fundamentally, experiencing the things that many of the women who spoke to us say they experienced, it makes work harder. It makes it more difficult to be in this space.
Over the weekend, one of the top names in Lansing city politics, Virge Bernero, the former mayor, dropped out of running for another term at City Hall after, Emily, your reporting brought to light some pretty serious allegations of sexual harassment, propositions, unwanted touching, and conversations that were overtly sexual. He's not very old. He's middle-aged anyway, not so old that you can dismiss him as being, you know, something of another generation who doesn't understand the modern workplace and how women expect to be treated. At the same time, there was a recent case where the lobbyist T.J. Buchholz, who's Gen X, came under fire for egregious sexual harassment charges at work. Do you think that there's any generational element of giving men a cover from having come from either a different era or having been a creature of Lansing more generally that has provided and still provided safety to people who are behaving inappropriately?
You know, sort of pinging off what Lauren said, you know, I think that women have done a really good job standing up for each other on this. I've talked to women certainly who have stood up to people, you know, seasoned professionals like Kelly Rossman McKinney is in the story. You know, she had actually confronted T.J. Buchholz because she heard this circulating in the rumor mill and told him, like, you need to stop this. We need more men to do that, frankly. And, you know, they do get a level of protection, I think, because some of this is so commonplace, because the Capitol is a weird work environment. I can't think of many other workplaces where you're regularly hanging out with your subordinates in some cases or colleagues in other cases at 4 o'clock in the morning. And I can't think of many other workplaces where you're, you know, you're, all your networking opportunities are sort of these out of office fundraisers, booze laden events, right? So I really do think that there are some unique factors here, but that men have a really big role to play in sort of peer enforcement, number one. I've heard stories of men sticking up for their female employees, but it's hard sometimes. And also just like the pure politics of the situation. You know, I've talked to women who have said that they didn't feel comfortable reporting their sexual harasser because their boss had a bill in his committee or something like that. So I really do think that there's some politics and some layers to this, but that men can make a difference if they read this story and take it seriously.
The voice of Emily Lawler, reporter for MLive. We're also talking with her colleague, Lauren Gibbons. You can read their story, Butt Pinching, Threesome Requests, and a Glass Ceiling, online at MLive right now. Emily, Lauren, it's great to hear from you. Thank you.
Hey, thanks for having us, and
thanks
for
so much.
Subject.
And that's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and by our director, Mercedes Mejia, with additional help from Catherine Newhan, Nell Ovett, and Olive Scott. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.